Hello and welcome to Making Risk Better, a podcast series produced in partnership with AIG. With a panel of security risk experts, we'll discuss the impact of conflict, kidnapping, piracy, and terrorism on global business. Our host is Dr. Alessandro Arduino, Principal Research Fellow at the Middle East Institute, National University of Singapore, whose two decades of experience in China encompasses security analysis and crisis management.
Welcome to Making Risk Better. I'm your host, Alessandro Arduino. Initially, we planned in our first episode to discuss piracy. We were looking at Somalia and West Africa. But still, as my favorite strategist, heavyweight boxer champion Mike Tyson say, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. So today, we are going to look in our episode of Making Risk Better to one question. What happens when you are working in a foreign country and suddenly you find yourself in the front line? Imagine the world collapses around you. Government and city are under siege, fighting rage, food, electricity, water is in short supply or even not available at all. Communications are disrupted and there is only a very limited access to cash or gasoline. So the big question is, what do you do? I mean, it's not hard to imagine. Not long ago, 10,000 of foreigners and Afghans beleaguered Kabul International Airport to flee Afghanistan when the Taliban took over. Those images that now looks years ago, but it was just a few months ago, have been superseded by ruins of the city bombed by the Russian military in Ukraine, Mariupol, Kiev, Kharkiv. And there are foreign workers and others that have found themselves trapped in Ukraine since Russia invaded the country on February 24th. So as you see, Ukraine and Afghanistan illustrated just two of the potential risk to business and others posed by geopolitical, ethnic, religious, and social tension. So today we are going to explore what are the implications and considerations for the people in the vicinity of such event. Asset maybe can be destroyed, seized, or even abandoned, and there's going to be a wider impact on brand, reputation, and revenue. So if we are looking specifically at Ukraine and we want boots on the ground, Alex Kemp is the expert to guide us through the dealing with situation that could strike closer to home than one thing. Alex has a 9 years of experience as a Royal Marine officer, and now he is responsible for strategic development of the Crisis Management Business Unit for Crisis 24. He knows firsthand what it entails to exfiltrate people out of war-ravaged Ukraine. Alex, can you tell our audience some of the consideration for a company and their employee that should be included in their evacuation? Let's say in a nutshell, how do I get my people out?
Yeah, thank you, Alex. The first thing I would say is that we've, for the last 15 years or so, have been actively involved, as has the business, in working with a variety of organizations dealing with a host of crises precipitated by either some form of man-made or natural disaster, or indeed some form of destabilized geopolitical event. We've only got to look at, you know, the last couple of years. Even COVID presented itself as a scenario that required organizations to look at evacuating overseas staff and repatriating them and their dependents, and obviously more recently, Afghanistan and Ukraine, as you've just mentioned.
Could you tell us more about the macro perspective? I mean, from an organizational standpoint and some of the specific challenge posed by evacuation.
The first thing I would say is that, and this is often overlooked in an organization, is recognition that if you're going to operate in volatile markets, that you may have issues with either localized or countrywide or indeed regional need to relocate people or indeed evacuate people should there be a deterioration in events. Clearly, from the sort of environmental type disaster that I mentioned, whether it be kind of tsunami or a man-made disaster such as the nuclear disaster in Japan, that presents a sort of sudden deterioration that also requires a similar response from the organization. But recognition that the organization should address this in their overall corporate crisis management plans, in their corporate risk registered, in their business continuity plans. All too often it is overlooked, and a degree of complacency in some cases exists to actually ensure that the message and the narrative from, for example, a local management team who are probably quite sensitized or desensitized to potentially an international view on what, you know, maybe going on in that country. And we certainly saw that in Ukraine with local management staff really not believing that this buildup of Russian military capability on the border was going to actually result in an invasion. And as a result, organizations were quite late to react in some cases.
Taking into account the reality of what's been happening on the ground, how can businesses learn from this?
So as you set that sort of recognition within the business, it's also understanding that if there is an appetite and a desire, and of course this comes down to risk tolerance within the organization, is understand that if the situation does destabilize, what are the strategic objectives of the business? And, you know, do you intend to continue operating there come what may through the conflict? Or are there certain outcomes? And again, this can all be dynamically worked through as you're addressing the crisis. Are you going to continue your business operations in that particular country? Because that will determine how the organization is going to deal with evacuation of expatriate staff and dependents, and indeed the local national staff, which I'll consider separately shortly. So understanding how the strategic objective of the business correlates into that, and then giving a crisis management structure, and this is more than a plan. We, you know, plan is generally not worth very much unless it is fully embedded in the organization's culture and approach, and therefore that the structures, the crisis management structures around that, need to have sufficient decision-making authority and have considered all of the events and had a very honest view on, you know, the vulnerabilities that lie. And no plan will ever be perfect, and it will never survive contact with the first chain of events that unfolds, but a plan is a good basis on which to change your mind. And so having a very honest and realistic crisis management structure that is empowered by the organization to make decisions quickly is also important. And it should consider the black swan events, and it should exercise regularly against those, because the exercising, and this can generally be done in 2 to 3 hours, facilitated by people that have sat in the midst of these crises, can quickly unpick items that are likely to prove problematic.
Are there any recent scenario to help illustrate this?
Yeah, for example, in Ukraine, you know, the provision of cash on the ground to facilitate operations and evacuation is essential, but actually securing cash in Ukraine is really difficult at the moment. Medical capability to look after people who, you know, who've perhaps relied on essential medicines, and how you're going to get that to them. Gathering personal identifiable information in the data protection age that we live in has proved incredibly challenging. Trying to pass individuals who are looking to evacuate personal data to a third party on the ground presents all sorts of data protection challenges. And sometimes the organizations don't have the required level of PII to enable that to occur. So that structure really enables this, and training and regularly exercising it allows that all to be unpicked and dealt with before the sudden deterioration in events. So that's really the operational side of things. And importantly, I mean, organizations are really good at making big decisions from a business and contractual and commercial standpoint. It's important as much to be monitoring, and we call it horizon scanning, the geopolitical environment, looking for where those deteriorations might occur, having the early indicators, and ensuring that the appropriate level of the organization is able to respond to that.
once there is an awareness of this early indicator, what system or even what kind of processes are needed for organization to respond?
Yeah, coupled to that is having the communication systems, both at a kind of C-suite and a crisis management level, but indeed right down to the local national employee on the ground, so that you can communicate as an organization with them effectively. And there's all range of mass communications tools that can be used to communicate quickly and effectively with people on the ground. I mean, actually, the data networks and Wi-Fi and such like has largely, not in all parts of Ukraine, for example, work quite effectively through the conflict. And so messaging and phone calls has been possible. But having backups and for a breakdown in communications and ensuring that you can corral people quickly, for example, advise them of where they need to go to a rendezvous point to be picked up by an evacuation vehicle or other facilitation of where you're going to move them within the country is important. So having that communications framework within the organization is important. And also having the ability to quickly call upon augmentation of support to deal with the crisis is another point that has been very evident both through Afghanistan and Ukraine, is organizations generally don't have sufficient a spare capacity within their existing workforce to put to bear to handle an event such as this. It's so overwhelming on the organization, not just in terms of evacuating expatriate staff, but also focusing on the so what for the local national staff who may or may not be left behind.
Oh, thank you, Alex. That's very important. I mean, when you say organization need to be prepared for the unexpected, but there are some time when there are unaware or unprepared. I mean, the big question is, how does anyone avoid getting stuck in a conflicted situation? And the very easy answer is don't go anywhere near to a conflict. But as you mentioned, in reality, it's more complicated than that. I mean, it boils down to risk calculation. And I always like to quote Ernest Hemingway, Bill Rice, when he's questioned how someone goes bankrupt. And he say, gradually, then suddenly. So you showcase it as how we moved from gradually 190,000 soldier in the border of Ukraine, and then suddenly the invasion. And then still people, and we are talking about foreign workers, got stuck in Ukraine. So can you give us more detailed example how you managed to exfiltrate, let's say, from point A to point B foreign worker, but also I think a very important part is the local worker, how you protect their family. I mean, as Ukrainians need to stay in their country to fight, women and children are moving out the country, and as a company, how the company can include them in their evacuation plan.
Yeah, thank you, Alex, and good question. We always say early preparation is key here, and understanding against those objectives what the organisation should be doing. And so there's a raft of, you know, US State Department, UK FCDO, and other government overseas advisories and foreign ministries who will be advising when staff should leave. But of course, organisations need to consider that in their own context. Making an early call to get non-essential staff out, non-essential dependents, and this is particularly for expatriate staff, is crucial. And indeed, as we saw with Afghanistan and Ukraine, commercial air, that you could buy tickets for, was available. So early movement on that was important. However, also behind was left effectively essential staff who would keep business operations going and also continue to manage the local national staff that are on the ground. So establishing that sort of communication structure, running a what we might call a warden system, something that you can get mass communication out to people quickly and focus on specific target groups to make sure that they understand what's going on and when they should start to move is important. With regard to Ukraine, obviously we saw most expatriate staff, I mean, some did evacuate after the invasion, but we saw a huge raft of local national staff left on the ground in Ukraine. And I think this is really a testament to many of the corporate organizations today, is is having provided advice to that group of local nationals to shelter in place as the invasion took place, came to one of being actually assisting those staff with evacuating from the country. And the question with local national staff is, you know, do they have somewhere to move to, and do they actually want to leave? We've seen in Ukraine, obviously, 18 plus year old males and up to 60 are unable to leave the country, and therefore encouraging local national staff to move has resulted in having to break up a family unit potentially. And indeed, how far does the corporate organisation stretch its definition of which dependents are included within that? So, you know, we've obviously seen the mass refugee movements, and this has been very much supported by the international response to effectively managing refugees and providing refuge for them outside of Ukraine. But options to move in country have been a variety of self-propelling out of the organisation, using the incredibly effective rail links that were and continue to run in some cases today, or indeed providing contracted means to move from the country. But often this has required quite a lot of persuasion by organisations to encourage their local national staff to come out of shelter, particularly if they're in a war-ravaged area, and move. I don't think any of us can really appreciate how horrendous this has been for the people of Ukraine. And they've been asked to make pretty impossible decisions, leaving everything behind, you know, even leaving pets behind. We've seen individuals ask if they can bring their pets with them, having to say farewell to elderly relatives. Where does, as I mentioned earlier, where does that definition of dependent actually stop? So once that decision has been made, if they're going to move, it's then via a series of means. And there's no really good solutions available in a war-torn country. You're trying to make do with the best of the situation on the ground. And I think it's worth just flagging for a point for organisations at this stage that under pressure in a war-torn environment like this, and having to go through a kind of lengthy on-border and enhanced sort of due diligence process on security vendors who can support on the ground under pressure when actually need to move people can prove quite challenging. And also augmenting that support capacity internally. I mean, organisations that are moving large volumes of local nationals about generally don't have the capacity to do that within their own resources. So leaning on a support infrastructure and getting people into the organisation early to do that is important.
In such challenging and time-sensitive situation, how else can organisation work to keep individuals safe?
The other very useful approach that has been taken in Ukraine is the use of safe havens. And effectively, for local national staff who are clearly very frightened but are absolutely set on not leaving Ukraine, it is possible to move them within the country to less high-risk areas where they can be looked after better, medical resupply, particularly for essential medicines, foodstuffs, water, can be more easily provided to them. And additionally, you're not then breaking up the family unit that is in existence. And as I say, that's been a true credit to organisations that, particularly against historic similar evacuations, may have just instructed local national staff to take in place, have very much taken a strong duty of care, perhaps linked to ESG, set of principles on this, and working closely with their local national staff. The last point I would make on that is the other point we've seen is even if a local national staff member and their dependents say they don't want to move on the first instruction is to keep asking them, because the situation changes on the ground. And generally they're scared, very emotional, as I alluded to earlier, and not wanting to move. So continuing to press them and using, we've seen the use of psychologists, specialist negotiators, equipped on behalf of international organisations, trying to encourage people at least to move out of high risk areas so that they can be better cared for. And lastly, that just begs the question of when do organisations actually draw a line under that support to local national staff? I mean, all wars eventually end via some form of negotiated settlement, and this one may well take that course. But at the moment, we see no let up in organisations' duty of care to their local national staff in continuing to support them for those who've both stayed in country and those who've left.
Thank you very much, Alex. And I truly believe what you mentioned, that it's a duty of care at its best. But as it's already very clear that it's so complex in moving people inside Ukraine, then if we look at all the legal aspect that this entails, and then we have the right expert to answer to this question, and he is Richard Nilon. Richard is a lawyer based at HFW, an international law firm specialized in dealing with legal aspect of crisis response for organization operating in the region. Richard, I do believe that when Alex's work finish, your job start. So I'm going to ask you, what are the legal issues that are likely to arise where your employee require emergency evacuation?
Thank you, Alex. Well, the first question is often, where does responsibility lie? You know, to what extent does the employer have a legal or an ethical obligation to deal with the situation, or for that matter, even prevent the employee being exposed to that risk in the first place? Now, certainly my experience is that when there is an emergency situation and when one occurs, the motivation of the employer, and particularly the manager dealing with the situation, is often not a legal motivation. You know, they don't reach for their big book that says duty of care. They are motivated by what's moral, what's ethical, and what's the right thing to do. And certainly with smaller companies, we often find the person dealing with the problem within the employer, you know, might well know the employees personally. They might know of them. In larger companies, then the employer will be rightly concerned about how the treatment of their staff in danger will resonate across the company.
What will be the main issues around this for organization?
So a couple of key issues to start with. One, you know, the ethical decisions that are often taken, you know, what are often consistent with the legal obligations, and I'll come on to those in a second. It's often, though, reassuring to know that when, you know, these thoughts are going through the employer's minds, you have companies and support like Alex Kemp we've just heard from, and support by your insurers backing those decisions. So if we look at the ethical, but let's look at the legal situation. So what is the legal duty? Is there a legal duty on the employer to take care of its staff? Now, that can be quite a complex question. It would depend on the nature of the employment relationship, which laws govern the employment, and the nature of the assignment of the employee. And it's usually a combination of legislation and private rights. So dealing with legislation first, I mean, this is going to vary from country to country, of course. Again, it's dependent on the terms of employment and the nationality of the individual. But most countries, certainly including the UK, including the US, have health and safety at work legislation, which generally speaking imposes a duty on the employer to generally ensure the health and safety of every employee. It may or may not apply extraterritorially. That is, it may not apply elsewhere in the world, but even when that doesn't apply, there's usually other pieces of legislation. Workers' compensation, for example, legislation that provides detailed rules on what an employee is entitled to when things go wrong, sometimes to the exclusion of all the other remedies, sometimes without the employee having to prove any kind of fault.
And what could a worst case scenario or a collapse of duty of care look like for companies?
I mean, the worst case scenarios, there are certainly in the UK offences of corporate manslaughter where a company doesn't do what's required of them. But more often we're looking at general breaches of duty of care, you know, a general duty under substantive law that can impose duties and liabilities on an employer. And there's been quite a number of high profile cases over the years of employees or their family attempting to bring claims against the employer, sometimes in the context of personal injury, sometimes in context of kidnappings, and sometimes, regretfully, deaths abroad as well. So the key points for the employer is, you know, your duty of care is not just, particularly for staff on foreign assignments, it's not just in their place of work, it's outside of work, it could be socializing, it could be 24/7, and there is generally often a duty to assess and alleviate and deal with the perils that employees are exposed to and deal with their safety and their welfare connected with those overseas assignments. So as Alex Kemp said, we're talking about risk management policies, principles of prevention, avoiding risks, evaluating, mitigating, having a coherent policy, appropriate instructions and communication, contingency plannings, briefings, trainings, and having support services available to that employee. But the reality is when an employee gets hurt, even if an employer has done everything right, even if the employee was willing to accept the risk, even in return for hazard pay, often the argument that the employer could have done something different, could have implemented different precautions, is often quite compelling. And the employer needs to be mindful of that when preparing, and very mindful of that when implementing a response to these kind of situations. So those are the key duty side. Of course, it doesn't stop there. If you're actually moving employees, the challenges don't stop there. How people need to be moved, Alex has touched upon. And of course, that provides all sorts of challenges, mostly practical, mostly logistical, sometimes financial, of course, but often legal as well. And we saw this in places like Afghanistan, where there's concerns about bribery, there's concerns about sanctions. If a sanctioned entity controls the airport or controls the land borders, what can be done and what risks are there associated with money changing hands in those circumstances. So in summary, that's some of the legal issues that are likely to arise when an employee finds their employees in an emergency evacuation situation.
Thank you very much, Richard. You just give us the list about what a company really need to do. But as you just mentioned, sometime reality gets into the middle. So if we move from our bird's eye view on the legal issue on emergency evacuation, I would like now to look at the very particular and peculiar challenge that we have right now. And we see from the legal side what international company with people and asset in Ukraine have to do right now as we speak.
Sure. Well, speaking personally, a lot of the challenges and the biggest challenges I've been involved in relation to Ukraine have involved the maritime sector. And often we haven't seen too much focus on the maritime sector, but there's upwards of 70 vessels that are stranded in Ukrainian ports at the time of the hostilities. Each of those vessels has a crew on board. Often these are international workers, and these people have to be evacuated too. And when it comes to evacuating, let's say a crew and similar to employees in that are land-based, firstly, is there a desire to evacuate? We talked about the duty of care, but what about the employee's wishes? What about a crew member's wishes? Do they prefer to stay on their vessel? What are the risks associated with that? Or do they prefer to be moved? And if they're going to be evacuated, what are those risks and those challenges and those potential liabilities? I mean, certainly, in the west of Ukraine in the early days, the challenges were perhaps less intense than we see in the east, where there's greater areas of conflict. But when we're talking about some of the eastern ports and evacuating crews, evacuating employees, we're talking about moving people through areas of conflict. And plainly, there's some great challenges there. There's the practical hurdles, the financial ones, and also from the employer's side of things, what happens if something goes wrong? If that employee sustains injuries as they're being moved, who's responsible for that? Is it more dangerous for that employee to move rather than staying put? And who takes that decision? Is it for the employer to say, right, we're going to move you? Is it for the employer to say to the employee or the crew member, look, these are the two options. You can stay where you are. You can stay on your vessel. It doesn't seem like the Russians are specifically targeting commercial shipping. There have been some incidents, but they're not specifically targeting. Is it safer to stay where you are? Or do you want to be moved? And that movement includes being moved through an area of conflict.
And how would, an in-depth advanced risk assessment likely impact on this kind of scenario?
Risk assessments can be done, but as Alex Kemp said, often there's no good options. There are perhaps two unappealing options which you have to select from. Is it the obligation of the employer to dictate what happens? In many instances, the employees, the crew members have been given the choice. Do you want to stay or do you want to go? And keep in mind, the options are limited. Maybe we're not talking about movement with armored vehicles. There isn't a ceasefire. We're talking about local buses, limited protection from certain hostilities, and possibly dealing with different individuals on the ground, which may or may not have experience of this kind of thing.
as you see it, what is going to be really helpful in this case?
So, you know, it's always hugely helpful to have an international security company, and we have Alex Kemp here, that coordinates, that understands these things, understands what the risks involve, how to mitigate and minimize those risks, and of course have that endorsed by the insurer behind that. And have in mind, of course, that resources become an absolute premium when we're dealing with these kind of things in war zones. And as I said earlier, that, you know, if an employee does get hurt, even if the employer has done everything right, when the precautions are assessed, it can look quite compelling for the argument to say you should have done more. Turning to recommendations, now, all Alex Kemp has said about good practice is often directly consistent with the factors that are looked at when liability is considered when something has gone wrong. So we're talking about contingency planning. We're talking about ensuring that the employer has access to specialist support required in these kind of circumstances. And don't underestimate the value of having decisions and actions backed and supported by your insurer. The insurer can provide access to the support an employer needs in a crisis, but often the insurer will, of course, cover the financial exposure, and dealing with a crisis in a war zone can be very costly. Now, financial exposure may not seem so relevant in the grip of a peril when your concern is your people, but after things calm down, it can be hugely beneficial for the company to know that certain costs will be reimbursed and the financial cost of the incident will be taken care of and won't put the viability of the business at risk.
Richard, thank you. Both you and Alex mentioned that there is no perfect option. I mean, options are there, but are very limited. And that's why we really need to make risk better. In this respect, I'm asking our next expert, Dr. Neil Melvin, to look into the future of the current Ukrainian crisis. Dr. Neil Melvin is Director of International Security Study at the Royal United Service Institute, mostly known as RUSI. Neil, as the crisis in Ukraine is still unfolding, it really threatened to aggravate severe problems that the world economy has already been under heavy strain during the pandemic. And I'm talking about inflation, supply chain constraint, and so on. So what you will think will come next as an immediate crisis?
Yeah, thanks very much, Alex. I mean, we've gone through quite a few crises already around Ukraine, as you mentioned. I mean, in terms of, I think, what's likely to be the next focal point for a crisis, it's going to, on the battlefield, it's really going to be, I think, how Russia now tries to define the terms of victory. It started off this conflict thinking it could take Ukraine and it could do it quite easily. So plan A has gone pretty spectacularly wrong for the Russians for a variety of reasons. Now there seems to be a growing sense of crisis almost on the Russian side, is that they need to construct a version of victory in Ukraine that they can sell to the international community and that they can also sell domestically. And that is going to be about trying to occupy territory in the east of Ukraine and destroy the Ukrainian armed forces to some degree. So I think we're going to have a very focused battle around this issue, with the Ukrainians trying to prevent that happening and the Russians desperate to assert themselves on this issue. And this, of course, continues to have enormous impacts economically. And I think, you know, one of the immediate crises coming out of this, particularly as regards the summer, is going to be the impact on food security. Ukraine is a major supplier of global food, as well as Russia. We're already seeing, I think, in many countries in Africa and Asia, concern about how this focused fighting dragging now on into the beginning of the summer may affect food security.
Neil, at this stage, what are you seeing if we look at the long-term geopolitical consequence and also what it means for the future of warfare?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are many, many aspects to the impact of this. And of course, it's going to be difficult to work out all of them. But I think at this point, I would see three main geopolitical impacts. First of all, Russia is going to emerge from this crisis almost inevitably weaker and perhaps more dangerous, a more cornered country. you know, the latest, I think, feeling that we're getting to see in Russia is that they started off with this ambition to be a great power, and that, that asserting control over Ukraine was part of that. So failing to achieve what they thought they could do with Ukraine, which is perceived to be a relatively weak neighbor, is really going to dent this image of Russia as a global great power. It's going to be much more restricted. And of course, President Putin will feel the pressure domestically. And as I say, maybe a more dangerous actor, more unpredictable and cornered person. And of course, this does also shift the balance in the bilateral relationship Russia and China. So Russia is going to be in a weaker position vis-a-vis China. Secondly, I think the big takeaway from this is a more united West, a sort of unity we haven't seen in the West really since the Cold War days. That, I think, is going to carry on. There's going to be a lot of momentum in that. We won't see necessarily the total unity carrying on, and there will be disagreements. But nonetheless, the crisis, I think, has pushed the West to cross a line in which it was trying to avoid entering into a larger geopolitical struggle with countries such as Russia or China and others emerging. And now there is a feeling that the West has to act in a different way. We've seen that. And so that's going to be one key takeaway. And thirdly, I think it is the growing awareness that Asia is part of a wider set of security equations. So it's impossible to manage Russia without actually taking account of Asia. So fundamentally, this is about China. But as we've seen on sanctions and diplomacy, it's also been about making sure that or trying to actually line up India rather unsuccessfully, but making sure that Japan and South Korea are there to enforce sanctions. And so European and Indo-Pacific security have been more closely interlinked as a result of this. And we're going to have to take account of that.
How do you see this influencing what the future of warfare look like?
In terms of the future of warfare, I mean, there's a lot of discussion about this. I think some people are concluding that the type of warfare that Russia has been famous for, this new large armored divisions moving across sort of continental spaces, has been rendered obsolete because of modern anti-tank weapons and drones and satellite intelligence and so on. I think that that's not entirely true. We've seen really two conflicts recently, in the Nagorno-Karabakh and the Ukraine one, where people are drawing lessons around the old-style warfare being obsolete. I think actually that while that may be true, what we've also seen is that the Russians and the Armenians in the Karabakh war failed to use their equipment effectively. It wasn't used in an integrated way, and so they've been open to this kind of warfare. So I think if we had a different kind of focus on the Russian side, a more integrated and better organized approach, where you'd had a combined arms operation with air power, with air defense, with the armor and infantry working together, it would have been a different story. I think NATO armies operate in that way. So I wouldn't say that old forms of warfare are totally obsolete as a result of this conflict.
Thank you very much, Neil. I mean, you just underlined how a more dangerous Russia is going to increase uncertainty. And basically, it's on the same line of what we have been discussing with Alex and Richard. And they underline the very fundamental thing. Crisis management is essential for business. You need a plan. Nevertheless, that plan can be disrupted by event and by this increasing uncertainty, but it's certainly something that you need to do, and you need to do right now. So thank very much to Neil, Alex and Richard, and a very special thank to all our audience for being with us today. Thank you and goodbye.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by our speakers are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no representations as to accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series, and will not be liable for any errors, omissions, or delays in this information, or any losses, injuries, or damages arising from its use.